Ladies and gentlemen, we would like to welcome you to this first afternoon session of the Sunstone Theological Symposium. We trust that you will all be recovering from lunch and not let the amount of food that you eat detract in any fashion from the, I'm sure, interesting discussion that will be had here in the next hour. Our first speaker this afternoon will be Professor Marvin S. Hill, who's professor of history at Brigham Young University. The topic of his paper and discussion is entitled The First Vision Controversy, a comment on sectarian versus historical interpretation. Following Professor Hill, Van Hale will discuss history and criticism of the text of the King Follett Discourse. Following Mr. Hale's comments, we will enjoy a response from James B. Allen, who is professor of history at BYU. Thank you.
Ever since Fawn Brody wrote No Man Knows My History in 1946 and emphatically denied that there was any valid evidence that Joseph Smith experienced a visitation from the Father and Son in 1820, an enormous amount of energy has been expended by scoffers and Latter-day Saints to disprove or prove the first vision story.
You need your mic in front of the
door. Okay, thanks. Until recently, both sides have agreed that the truth or untruth of Mormonism was at stake, and neither side has conceded merit to the opposing point of view. It is my purpose to review the issues and arguments and offer what seems to me to be a plausible interpretation based on available evidence that I believe might reconcile some of the disagreements while giving fair consideration to the various accounts written by Joseph Smith. Brody, of course, argued that Joseph Smith fabricated his vision in 1838 when he began dictating his history to provide a starting point for his prophetic career that would counter the charge that he was a money digger and charlatan turned prophet. She quoted part of the vision which has become familiar to Latter-day Saints and scholars. She said that after a revival at the age of 14, Joseph recorded that he had sought divine guidance in a wooded grove. I'm going to skip, I think, the quotations in the paper. They are familiar, I'm sure, to 95% of you. Brody observed that similar visions were commonplace in Western New York in this period, that the Palmyra newspapers made no mention of Joseph's vision, although he said he was persecuted for telling it, that his mother and close relatives ignored it or confused it with the visit of Moroni, as did Oliver Cowdery in the first published history of the church, that Joseph himself did not publish his account until 1842. What started as a hypothesis in a scholarly biography soon became a dogma to many of the church's enemies. Brody, out of the church by the time she revised her volume in 1971, clung tenaciously to her thesis despite much new evidence, adding a supplement to her original work to defend her position. She insisted that the recent new discoveries bear out my original speculation that the first vision, if not an invention, was an evolutionary fantasy beginning in a half-remembered dream, stimulated by the early revival excitement and reinforced by rich folklore of visions circulating in the neighborhood. In the fall of 1967, Reverend Wesley P. Walters, pastor of the Presbyterian Church in Marissa, Illinois, and a vigorous opponent of Mormonism, wrote a piece in support of Brody's position in the Bulletin of the Evangelical Theological Society. His article, entitled New Light on Mormon Origins from Palmyra, New York Revival, repeated much of Brody's argument and went on to question whether a revival of the size which Joseph describes, where great multitudes joined the various churches in Palmyra, could have occurred in 1820. Walters said, such a revival does not pass from the scene without leaving some traces in the records and publications of the period. Walters pointed out that in the first published version of the vision, written by Oliver Cowdery in 1834, Cowdery said the revival occurred in 1823, when Joseph was 17 years old, and that Reverend George Lane of the Methodist preached up the revival in Palmyra. Walters insisted that Joseph Smith in his 1838 account and Cowdery in 1834 had the same revival in mind, since they both agree that the revival started with the Methodists, that Baptists and Presbyterians were also involved, and that large additions were made to these denominations. In both accounts, Walter said, Joseph was confused by sectarian controversy and refrained from joining any church. In both, a vision was received in answer to Joseph's prayer. Walters argued that Joseph Smith could not have been confused about which group to join in 1820, been enlightened that all were wrong, and then become confused again on the same point in 1823. There was but one revival in 1824, so that Joseph was quite wrong in dating it in 1820, and also wrong in much of the rest of his story. Walters noted that the prophet's younger brother, William, confirms the point that it was Reverend Lane who stirred the Palmyra revival, and states that it was this minister who suggested the text, James 1 and 5, if any of you lack wisdom, to which Joseph responded. Walters also indicated that William Smith says that Reverend Stockton, a Presbyterian, played a significant role at the revival. Walters observed that William says that Joseph Smith Sr. did not like Stockton because he had affirmed at Alvin Smith's funeral that Alvin had gone to hell. As a result, Walters insisted that the revival must have occurred after Alvin's death, that is, in 1824. Walters argued that most Mormon writers have utilized all these details, but without recognizing the inconsistency between them. Walters said that Lane and Stockton did not appear in Palmyra until 1824, when they were both given ministerial assignments there. Stockton first visited Palmyra in October 1823 and was not installed as the pastor of the Presbyterian Church there until February 1824. George Lane labored in the Susquehanna district over 150 miles from Palmyra until July of 1824, when he was assigned to that town. Lane and Stockton then could not have been together working in Palmyra until the summer of 1824. Obviously then, if William Smith's account is right, and Oliver Cowdery's, that Lane was there and Stockton was there, it has to be 1824. Walters cited an account by George Lane in the Palmyra Wayne Sentinel, dated September 15, 1824, which says that the revival began at Palmyra, but soon spread abroad to other communities and churches. Walters also cited a Baptist periodical that by the end of the year, more than 300 souls had joined churches in Palmyra. Thus, Joseph's recollection of great multitudes joining the church seems accurate, but Walters insisted the prophet was wrong on his dating, that when we return to the year 1820, the great multitudes are conspicuously missing. The Presbyterians had no awakening that year, as Reverend James Hodgkin makes clear, and the Baptist records also show no significant increase in members. Methodist figures for the entire circuit show a net loss of 23 for 1819 and 6 for 1820. In addition, the religious press makes no mention of any revival in 1820, although it does so in 1817 and then again in 1824. Walters summarized these points by asking, what lines of approach are open to the student of Mormon history as he considers Joseph Smith's vision? Walters maintained that some will try to imagine that a great revival did occur in 1820, but Walters doubted that they would find factual confirmation for this. Walters said that a better line of argument would be to say that Joseph was wrong about the date, but such an argument would force Mormon apologists to place the vision in the spring of 1825, at which time Smith would be 19 years old, not an innocent boy of 14, and his vision would have occurred after the supposed visit of Moroni in September 1823. Walters next considered the version of the first vision written by Joseph Smith in 1832, but found that this contradicted the 1838 version by making Joseph Smith 16 instead of 14, by having one personage appear instead of two, the personage being Jesus Christ, and by having Joseph seek the plates to obtain riches. This version also has Joseph reading the Bible before inquiring of God, with no mention being made of a revival. These discrepancies seem to Reverend Walters to discredit the 1838 account and thus to undermine Joseph's credibility. Walters argued that a more plausible interpretation would be that Joseph Smith started with a different story and that he altered and expanded the vision story as he went along. Walters, borrowing from Obadiah Dogberry and E.D. Howe, indicated that the earliest form of the story was that Joseph Smith had discovered the plates by means of a seer stone, that a spirit had come to inform him where they were located. Only later did the story take on a religious tone with the coming of an angel and then a visitation of Jesus Christ as the story got more elaborate. Walters had taken a position here similar to Brody's, seeing fraud and deception at the root of early Mormonism as Joseph Smith moved from money digger to prophet. Two other heirs of Brody were Gerald and Sandra Tanner, whose case against Mormonism in 1968 had a chapter on the first vision. Like Brody, the Tanners were renunciants of the church, whose disillusionment was to a considerable extent influenced by No Man Knows My History. This work is consistently maintained as the standard against which the church's position on Joseph Smith is measured. Less professional in their outlook than Brody or perhaps Walters, the Tanners have been mostly concerned with discrediting prominent Mormons who have written on the first vision, often making use of the latest arguments by active Mormons published in scholarly works. In their modern microfilm publication, they have distributed a great many early Mormon works to demonstrate inconsistencies with present church doctrine. In their 1968 treatment, the Tanners began by quoting the 1838 version of the vision and then cited James B. Allen, George Q. Cannon, and Bruce R. McConkie on the importance of the vision for the Mormon believer. Allen has quoted that the first vision is a fundamental belief to which all loyal Mormons must adhere. Cannon, that there can be no truth, the true faith without a true knowledge of God, is set forth in the vision. And McConkie, that the visitation in the grove was the most important historical event since the end of Christ's ministry, that by this means the creeds of apostate Christendom were smashed. David O. McKay has also quoted that the first vision is the foundation of the faith, and Apostle John A. Witzo, that upon the reality of the vision rests the truth and value of Joseph Smith's subsequent work. The Tanners focused their attention on contradictions in the differing accounts and had a running debate with Mormon apologists, attempting to demonstrate factual discrepancies in the pro-Mormon interpretations. They disputed Hugh Nibley's contention that Joseph considered his vision sacred and thus did not mention it often, citing Joseph's own remark that his telling of the story in 1820 led to a relentless persecution by sectarian leaders. They argued that one of the most damaging evidences against Joseph Smith in the 1820 account is that Section 84 of the Doctrine and Covenants indicates that no man can see God and live without possessing priesthood authority and ordinances. Joseph, they argue, violated his own principle by claiming the vision of the Lord before he received the priesthood. The Tanners picked up on Brody's argument that the first vision story was not published until 1842, and noted that James Allen affirms that if Joseph told the story in the 1820s, he ceased to do so by the 1830s, since there is no evidence that the story was being circulated at that time. True, they admit, Alexander Niebuhr retells the story in his journal, but this is not until 1844, after the vision had been reported in the Times and Seasons. Pomeroy Tucker referred to the vision in 1867, but he had an angel coming to Joseph in 1823 to say that the churches were all wrong. Oliver Cowdery's version of the vision seemed to the Tanners to confirm their interpretation. Cowdery states that he will provide a full and correct history of the rise of the church and tells his readers that Joseph Smith had offered to assist him. But Cowdery affirms that the vision came in 1823, that there was one personage who delivers the message that Joseph's sins are forgiven, and then tells him that a history was deposited in a place nearby. That is referring to the Book of Mormon plates. The Tanners noted the many contradictions between this and the 1838 story and declared that certainly this history refutes the story that the father and son appeared to Joseph Smith in 1820. The Tanners suspended a lot of their speculation about Mormon history on a conspiratorial theme. When they learned of the discovery of another version of the first vision in Joseph Smith's letter book written in 1832, the main question they asked was, why wasn't this made known earlier? They quoted Levi Edgar Young, a Mormon official, that he had seen a strange account of the first vision in 1958, but was told to say nothing about what it contained. They do not indicate who advised him to say nothing. The Tanners assumed that this was probably the 1838 version and stated that a careful reading of this document reveals why the church leaders have never published or referred to it. They pointed out that in this version, Joseph had already decided that the existing churches were untrue before he went into the woods to pray, which contradicted his statement in 1838 that it never entered into my heart that all were wrong. In 1832, Joseph's age is given as 16, not 14, and he makes it clear that it is Jesus Christ who appears to him rather than the Father and the Son. That is, it is one personage, not two. In the 1832 account, no revival is mentioned, and nothing is said about an evil power menacing him. The Tanners concluded that the only reasonable explanation for the Father not being mentioned is that Joseph did not see the Father and the Son, and that he made up this part of the story after he wrote his account in 1832. In their tract, the Tanners also considered another version of the vision written in 1835, which again fails to mention any revival, which has only one personage appearing, but then later another, contrary to the 1838 account, which has them appearing simultaneously. Thus the Tanners remarked, if this is not bad enough, Joseph also states that there were many angels. The Tanners conclude, now we have three different accounts of the first vision, and every one of them is different. We would, of course, expect some variations in any story, but we feel that there are so many variations, and they are of such a nature that they make it impossible to believe. In another aspect of their argument, the Tanners borrowed from Brodie again to maintain that others had visions similar to Joseph's. They affirmed, somewhat credulously, that Joseph Smith was influenced by Charles G. Finney, although they failed to notice that Finney's autobiography was not published until the 1870s, and that there is no evidence whatever that the story of Finney's vision reached Joseph Smith. They mention Asa Wilde and Stephen Bradley as two others who had visions similar to Joseph's. Tenacious in their efforts to disembowel Mormonism, the Tanners picked up on Walter's article and gave it full consideration in their book. They also hit back at Hugh Nibley, who in 1961 accused Mormon critics of garbling the first vision account. The Tanners argued that Joseph himself did not always get the story straight, nor did Orson Pratt in 1840, nor George A. Smith, nor Andrew Jensen, nor many others. The Tanners affirmed that Joseph Smith changed his doctrine concerning the Godhead and saw this as evidence of deceit. They cited the Book of Mormon, Ether 3 and 4, Mosiah 15, 1 and 5, to argue that Joseph Smith was initially a Trinitarian, that the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost were physically one, and cited the Lectures on Faith to show that Joseph taught that the Father was a personage of spirit. They commented cynically, can anyone honestly look at these three different accounts of the first vision and not admit that Mrs. Brodie was right, that Joseph Smith was a myth maker of prodigious talent? When Mormon scholars responded to the challenges made to the first vision story, it was the Walters revival that largely concerned them, although in 1969 in BYU Studies, they ran an entire issue on the first vision controversy with a piece by Dean Jesse, which included authenticated accounts of the 1832, 1835, and 1838 versions of the vision, taken from manuscript sources in the church archives. In this issue was a piece by Milton Backman of the BYU Religion Department, which took direct issue with Walters, examining church records, newspapers, historical accounts, to argue that there was some revival activity in Joseph's immediate neighborhood in that year, and a great deal more in the region and district of country where Joseph Smith said the multitudes joined the churches. Backman argued that there were camp meetings held by the Methodists in 1819-1820 at Phelps, a few miles from Palmyra, where five joined the Free Will Baptist, and where Joseph himself caught a spark of Methodism and became temporarily converted. Backman stressed that Joseph said the excitement began in his town, but that great numbers of converts came outside it. Backman said that within a radius of 25 miles, there were revivals at several towns. Backman argued, too, that all of Western New York was caught up in the Great Revival, and that this is the district of country that Joseph is talking about. Backman said that there were 1,513 converts in the Presbyterian churches in the burned-over district, that is, Western New York, in 1819, and similar gains among the Baptists. Backman argued that the Smiths could have read in the Pall Mall Register of revivals sweeping through Eastern New York, and that Joseph might have had this in mind when he spoke of great multitudes joining the churches in his history. That same year, 1969, Dialogue ran a roundtable discussion of the First Vision issues, in which Reverend Walters' early version of his paper which he had initially submitted to Dialogue in 1967, was reproduced with a critique by Richard Busman and also a response by Walters himself. Walters took exception to Ackman's thesis here that District of Country meant a statewide revival, stating that Joseph would not have considered statewide revival significant, for they were occurring on a regular basis in New York during the so-called Second Great Awakening, and that Joseph's point was that an unusual excitement was going on right in, quote, the place where we lived, unquote. Walters also questioned whether there was a large enough revival at Vienna Phelps to meet Bachman's requirements, since Abner Chase of the Methodists speaks of a spiritual decline at the time of the 1819 conference. Walters suspected that the revival on the Vienna Road was not 15 miles from Palmyra in the town of Vienna, but at the campground on the Vienna Road just outside Palmyra. Walters did not think those at this camp meeting, the converts or the converts to the Presbyterian or Baptist faith at Phelps, added up to great multitudes. Walters repeated his previous conclusion that Joseph's error in dating is more than a mere lapse of memory, that all the contradictions show that his memory was extremely confused, and that the matter is far deeper than a mere lapse of memory. It enters into the very fabric of the story itself. In his response, Richard Busman repeated many of the points made by Bachman and maintained that it was folly to try to explain every change in the vision accounts as the result of Joseph's calculated efforts to fabricate a convincing story. Busman questioned Walter's point that Lane could only have been there in 1824, saying this fact depends on Oliver Cowdery's account, which of course Walters doubts the validity of, and Busman noted that Cowdery placed the revival in 1823, 2 years sooner than Walters' explanation would allow. Thus, Walters can't give Oliver Cowdery full credence either. Borrowing from a point made by Larry Porter, Busman maintained that George Lane could have heard Joseph in 1819 when he passed Neil Palmyra on the way to some Methodist meetings. But that he repeats that the Lane story was told by, the George Lane story was told by Cowdery, not by Joseph Smith. Bushman also held that Cowdery was in Missouri when he started his 1834 history, and that he then moved to Ohio, to Norton, Ohio, and that he probably didn't have much time to spend with Joseph Smith, who of course was in Kirtland, and therefore Joseph could not have given Oliver very much help when he wrote his, when Oliver wrote his version of the first vision story. Bushman said that when it comes down to it, Walter's argument rests on the subjective judgment of how far is far and how big is big. How near do towns have to be to come within the region of country which Joseph Smith describes? How many converts have to be made for a 14-year-old boy to call it multitudes? When Walters describes his 1824 revival, he includes towns like Williamson, Ontario, Manchester, Sulphur Springs, Vienna, Lyons, and Macedon as nearby, and Menden, Geneva, Gorham, and Clyde as not too far away. For 1820, Bachman and Walters agree that Farmington, Penfield, Rochester, Lima, West Bloomfield, Junius, and Oak Corners were within a 25-mile radius, and thus conceivably within the region of country. Bushman points out that the Lyons circuit of the Methodist Church had an increase of 280 in 1820, and that even by Walter's standards, this would be considerable. Thus, he says, there may not have been such a dullness in religion in 1820 as Walters assumed. Bushman emphasizes what, for the Mormon apologist, is a critical point, that all that Joseph Smith said of the place where he lived was that there was an unusual excitement on the subject of religion, while the multitudes who joined the churches were said to be within the whole region of country. That's a very important distinction. Bushman thinks that seven revivals within a 25-mile radius is sufficient to meet Joseph's requirements. Bushman suspects that the Smiths covered considerable territory when they sold their cakes and beer at various social gatherings, and that they were thus familiar with a larger area than simply Palmyra or Manchester. Walters, reacting to Bushman, argued that Joseph's own history informs us that Joseph and Oliver were together on several occasions in the latter part of 1834, and thus it was quite possible for Joseph to fulfill his pledge to Oliver to help him with his 1834 narrative. Oliver's history then cannot be dismissed so easily. The 1832 account has Joseph's vision at age 16, which is closer to Oliver's 17 than the 14th year, which appears in the 1838 account. Walter's questions whether in the day when canal boats carried passengers 4 miles a day, it is realistic to consider towns 10, 15, and in some cases 25 miles away as the place where we lived. Walters, of course, missed the point that Bushman made here, that Joseph said only a religious excitement occurred here and that converts came in the region of country or the larger area. But Walters insists that the excitement was near enough to Joseph's home that there was pressure on the family to join the local Presbyterian church. It was close enough for Joseph to observe that a scene of great confusion and bad feeling ensued, and converts filed off, some to one party and some to another. Walters thinks these details make it clear that Joseph is talking about an area he knew intimately, that is, his hometown. In 1972, in their enlarged edition of Mormonism, Shadow or Reality, the Tanners made use of a discovery by Reverend Walters that the session records of the Western Presbyterian Church of Palmyra show that Lucy Smith and some of the children were active members of the Presbyterian Church until 1828, 8 years after Joseph's supposed vision in which he was told that all the churches were wrong. The Tanners questioned whether Lucy and her children took Joseph's claim of a vision very seriously. The Tanners also made use of another discovery of Walter's, that the Amboy Journal, April 30, 1879, and June 11, 1879, presented testimony of Joshua McCune, a minister, and Michael Morse, a brother-in-law to Joseph Smith, that Joseph himself sought membership in the Methodist Church at Harmony, Pennsylvania in 1828. The Tanners said this destroys any credence one can give to Joseph's statement that the Lord told him not to join any church. In 1980, Walters and the Tanners further elaborated on their arguments. Walters held that Bachman's study was a mere screen to confuse the average reader. Walters stated that in citing Blakesley, that a flaming spiritual advance came in 1820, Bachman misreads the dating, for Blakesley meant the denomination's calendar year, which would put it in 1821, not 1820. In writing of a religious cyclone in the Lyons Circuit, Blakesley was 3 years too early, as Reverend Chase indicates that there was no revival there until 1824. To reinforce his view that when Joseph said the place where I lived, he meant Palmyra, Walter cited Joseph's statement in the New York Spectator that the Reformation took place, quote, among the different denominations in the neighborhood where I lived, unquote. Lucy Mack Smith was also cited that her whole neighborhood, as she says, flocked to the meeting house during the revival. To Walters proves that we're talking here about Palmyra and not beyond. Walters cited the History of the Church, Volume 5, page 356, where Joseph speaks of the Mormon settlements of Nauvoo as a region of country, to maintain that in using that phrase he could not have meant a region more than, say, 20 miles across. Walters says that Joseph was not taking hikes of 30 to 40 miles to learn what was happening in other villages. On this point, Walters perhaps misunderstood Peter Crawley's point in a piece in Dialogue, where he argued that David Marks in Junius did exactly this in 1821, walking 25 and 35 miles at a time to attend revivals without considering it unusual. Thus, Crawley seems to suggest that Joseph might have done the same thing. Walters found confirmation of his view that the revival in question occurred in 1824 by citing the manuscript of Lucy Mack Smith's history. Her original narrative reported that the revival at which she became interested in the Presbyterian Church was after Alvin's death, which occurred in November 1823. Walters then concluded that recent validation of Joseph's 1838 account is wishful thinking by Mormon historians, saying that Dale Morgan was right when he said that there is little reality in Joseph Smith's early history. After weighing the arguments in this long and sustained controversy, where does one come down with respect to the Walters, Tanner, Bushman, Bachman, Crawley debate? Three nationally known scholars who have mentioned the first vision recently do not wholly agree with either side. Jan Schiff, a non-Mormon, admits with Walters that the events described by Joseph better fit the 1824 revival, but she adds that the confused chronology in the official history is no reason to doubt that Joseph had an early vision, which led him to stay away from organized religion. Lawrence Foster states flatly that at least as early as 1823, young Joseph began experiencing a series of visions, or what might be described as waking dreams, of unusual force and vigor, which totally reoriented his life. Klaus Hansen, a Mormon writing for a non-Mormon audience, says that because of their fragmentary nature, these accounts do not support firm conclusions for either side, but holds that Mormon scholars have raised valid objections to the contention that there is conclusive evidence that the revival did not occur. It is my belief that both sides have overlooked some important points, and that a plausible argument can be made for the basic church chronology, despite some contradictions in some sources, provided that concessions be made with respect to some inaccuracies in the 1838 account. It seems to me that everybody has approached the issue from the wrong end, by taking as the point of departure the 1838 official version, when the account they should be looking at is that of 1832, merely on the face of it. The 1832 version stands a better chance to be accurate and unembellished than the 1838 account, which was intended as a public statement streamlined for publication. When Joseph dictated his 1838 version, if he did dictate it, he was aware of what had been previously published by Oliver Cowdery and aware of his stature as a prophet of a new and important religious movement. It would be natural for him to smooth out the story to make it more logical and compelling than perhaps it seemed in 1820. But let me react first to the Walters-Backman war of words. It seems to me that Walters has scored some important points, although not nearly as many as he professes. I am inclined to agree with him that the turmoil that Joseph describes that led to some family members joining the Presbyterians and that led to much sectarian bitterness does not fit well into the 1820 context detailed by Backman. For one thing, it does not seem likely that there would have been so much sectarian strife in 1820 and then have a joint revival where all was harmony in 1824. In addition, as Walters notes, Lucy Mack Smith says the revival where she became interested in a particular sect came after Alvin's death. That's almost certainly in 1824. Indicating that the angel had told Joseph of the plates prior to the revival, Lucy adds that for a long time after Alvin's death, the family could not bear any talk about the golden plates, for the subject had been one of great interest to him, and any reference to the plates stirred sorrowful memories. She said she attended the revival with hope of gaining solace for Alvin's loss. That kind of detail is just the sort that gives validity to Lucy's chronology. She would not be likely to make up such a personal reaction of her own or the family's, nor mistake the time when it happened. I am persuaded that it was 1824 when Lucy joined the Presbyterians. And that, of course, is a critical point for dating the revival. Lucy's testimony is the most compelling part of Walters' argument. Walters has not proved his point about the neighborhood revival beyond doubt, since, as Bushman makes clear, Joseph never said that multitudes joined in Palmyra itself, but Walters is right in countering Bushman on Oliver Cowdery. Joseph and Oliver were together frequently in the latter part of 1834, so that something of the 1834 narrative probably came from Joseph, but we do not know how much. Cowdery had a lot of things right: that the revival in question came no earlier than 1823, that Lane was there, and that Moroni came afterward. Larry Porter's argument that Lane passed through in July 1820 and everything occurred at that time does not fit what Joseph said, for he indicated that he did not attend attend the revival meetings as often as occasion would permit. The revival Joseph is describing was a protracted one covering several days. It would take some time to generate the kind of excitement that Joseph recalled. A one-night stand won't do. Walters maintains that an 1824 revival destroys the credibility of Joseph Smith's whole story, since the revival occurred after Moroni's visit. Here, Walters appears more the anti-Mormon missionary than the objective scholar. An 1824 revival creates problems for the 1838 account, but not that of 1832. Walters overlooks the fact that Joseph said nothing in his 1832 account about a revival prompting his prayer. According to this version, and I quote, At about the age of 12, my mind became seriously impressed with regard to the all-important concerns for the welfare of my immortal soul, which led me to search the scriptures, believing as I was taught that they contained the word of God. Thus applying myself to them, and my intimate acquaintance with those of different denominations led me to marvel exceedingly, for I discovered that instead of adorning their profession by a holy walk and godly conversation agreeable to what I found contained in the sacred depository, this was a grief to my soul. Thus from the age of 12 to 15, I pondered many things in my heart concerning the situation of the world of mankind, the contentions and divisions, the wickedness and abominations. My mind became exceedingly distressed, for I became convicted of my sins, and by searching the scriptures I found that mankind did not come into the Lord, unto the Lord, but they had apostatized from the true and living faith, and there was no society or denomination built upon the gospel of Jesus Christ. So notice that he does come to this conclusion before the prayer. And when I considered all these things, I cried unto the Lord for mercy, for there was none else to whom I could go. The Lord heard my cry in the wilderness, and while in the attitude of calling upon the Lord in the 16th year of my age, a pillar of light above the brightness of the sun at noonday came down from above and rested upon me. And I was filled with the Spirit of God, and the Lord opened the heaven upon me, and I saw the Lord, and he spake unto me, saying, Joseph, my son, thy sins are forgiven thee. Go thy way, walk in my statutes, and keep my commandments. Behold, I am the Lord of glory, and I was crucified for the world. The world lieth in sin at this time, and none doeth good, no, not one. They have turned aside from the gospel and not kept my commandments. They draw near to me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. Not only does this account ignore the revival, so too does the 1835 account, which merely indicates that Joseph was wrought up in my mind respecting the subject of religion and looking at the different systems taught the children of men. I knew not who was right or who was wrong. Being thus perplexed in my mind, I retired to the silent grove. 1832 and 1835 say nothing at all about a revival. Neither does Lucy Mack Smith mention a revival when she describes Joseph's first vision, where an angel told him that the churches are man-made and also told him about the plates. She indicates that this vision occurred during the third year after their move to Manchester, which would make it 1820, since they left Palmyra for Manchester in 1818. Not only has Walters conveniently ignored this statement by Lucy, he fails to perceive that the absence of a revival in these sources makes his entire argument based on the dating of the revival suspect. To be sure, Joseph mentions the revival in 1838, but Walters gives that account no credence. In his statement to the editor of the Pittsburgh Gazette in 1843, Joseph merely said there was a reformation in the neighborhood where I lived, which of course says nothing about the size or the multitudes or anything else. In the Niebuhr account of 1844, a revival is mentioned where his mother got religion. But this, of course, is written after the 1838 version had been published. And so at least there is the possibility of some influence here. There is no mention in the Niebuhr account of large multitudes being converted. Oliver Cowdery stresses the magnitude of the revival, but is obviously thinking of 1824, Lucy's conversion and the coming of Moroni. William Smith also talks about the revivals, but he speaks of several between 1822 and 23, and says that Joseph's interest in religion came after the excitement had subsided, so that those revivals are not an integral part of Joseph's story. Orson Pratt, in his version published in 1840, says nothing at all about a revival. The Walters Tanner argument that Lucy's joining the Presbyterians and Joseph the Methodist destroys Joseph's credibility fails to consider that, unlike 1838, the 1832 version says nothing about Joseph being forbidden to join a church. Joseph does indicate here that he himself had decided, after studying the Bible, that there was no society or denomination that built upon the gospel of Jesus Christ, and the Lord told him that none doeth good. They have turned aside from the gospel. But he is not told by divine command to not join any church. Thus, there is no great inconsistency, as Walters and Tanners assume, when Lucy Mack Smith joins the Presbyterians, or Joseph tried to become a Methodist in 1828. Joseph was fairly convinced that all were wrong, but perhaps responded to the urgings of his wife, Emma, who had very close ties with the Methodists in Harmony, Pennsylvania. I am not certain at what point Joseph decided that he was to become a leader of a new religious movement. It may have been later than most Mormons realize. We must remember that in 1829 he received a revelation where he was told to pretend to no other gift than that of translation. as though even this late, 1829, the mantle of, he had not assumed the mantle of a prophet. At any rate, if Joseph Smith in 1838 read back into 1820 some of the details about a revival that actually occurred in 1824, there is no reason to conclude that he invented his religious experiences. Both 1820 and 1824 were traumatic times in his life, the former because as a teenager, responding to the great pressure that ministers and revivalists put on the youth of that day, he was very much concerned about his soul's salvation, and because in 1824 he found himself in the middle between his father and mother. Joseph Sr., having said that he was angry at the Presbyterians in 1824 and would join no church, Lucy, of course, making up her mind to join and taking Samuel and Hiram and Sophronia with her. Thus, Joseph is caught in the middle. He said he went to the revivals and found that he couldn't feel and shout like the rest. He wanted to, but he couldn't, which I suspect has to do with the fact that he just can't make up his mind between his mother and his father. If some local revivals earlier, between the ages of 12 and 15, had stirred young Joseph to seek after the Lord, then it was not so hard to confuse some of the details. Revivals had been a key factor in his life at different times. Giving priority to the 1832 account also makes it more understandable why Oliver Cowdery got his story tangled. He started out telling of Joseph's 1820 vision, perhaps along the lines of the 1830 version, with one personage involved. It seems apparent that Joseph must have said something to him in December after he published the story of George Lane and the revival. Joseph probably told him something about the fact that the Lane revival didn't occur until after Alvin's death in 1824. In any case, rather than admitting that he had gotten some details wrong and published them and straightening the story out, he just jumped in to tell the story of the coming of Moroni and thus to garble the whole story. I suspect that it was this narrative by Oliver Cowdery that influenced an awful lot of people, such as William Smith and George A. Smith and others, who get the story confused later on. Now, what's significant about the 1832 version is that it does not confuse the coming of Moroni and the 1820 vision. The two are separate and distinct. Another point deserves comment here. If initially Joseph said one personage came to him in 1820, it thus became easier for Oliver Cowdery to confuse this visit with the coming of Moroni than it would have been in a few years later when Joseph taught emphatically that there were three separate personages in the Godhead. The Tanners make much of the argument that Joseph Smith changed his view of the Godhead. There is a good deal of evidence that his understanding grew on many points of theology: his view of man and his potential, his view of salvation, of what it consists and how it is obtained. If, as the Tanners argue, Joseph grew in his understanding of the nature of the Godhead, this does not provide evidence of his disingenuousness. I do not agree with the Tanners that the 1835 narrative is no evidence that Joseph believed in two separate personages by that time. It is true, as the Tanners note, that the two personages are not specifically named. Yet it seems unlikely that Joseph would have distinguished between the two personages and the many angels he said he saw unless he thought that the two personages were something different. The 1835 version with its two personages stands at odds with the statement in the lectures on faith that God is a spirit. This is a conflict that nobody has really reconciled or explained. It seems to me that if the Latter-day Saints can accept the idea that Joseph gained his full understanding of the nature of God only after a period of time, not immediately in 1820, and most of the difficulties with chronology can be resolved. There is evidence that some Latter-day Saints have recently come to terms with their history on this point. Two excellent examples are the studies of James B. Allen and also that of Neil Lambert and Richard Craycroft. These Mormons examined the evidence first and then drew their conclusions. What is disturbing about the work of Reverend Walters and the Tanners is that they seem at times to reverse this process. They begin their look at Joseph Smith by accepting fully Fawn Brodie's basic arguments and never altering their position regardless of what evidence turns up. The rigid framework within which they perceive their subject, the invariably negative conclusions they reach, the frequent resort to dogmatic declarations, the finality they assume for their work suggests that they have something more at stake than most historians ordinarily do. To some extent, Reverend Walters, and to a considerable extent the Tanners, suffer from what Sidney E. Meade calls an anti-historical bias. They allow for no development in Joseph's thought. They hold up a very absolutistic model to which he is supposed to conform. They always assume that the worst motives influence the Mormon prophet. They begin with Brody's absurd notion that unless Joseph Smith told his vision sufficiently that the newspapers picked it up, and unless all the details are exactly alike, Joseph made the story up. It makes no difference to them that the story does appear in the first history which Joseph wrote in 1832 in his own hand, and that it appears in some form in all the accounts with which he had anything to do. The sort of rationalistic demands they make of Joseph Smith would play havoc with any belief in the resurrection of Christ. Nothing was written about this event for 30 years after, that is, the resurrection, and only by Jesus' most loyal followers. In telling the story of the resurrection, the gospel writers hardly agree on details as to who saw Jesus first, when and where, under what circumstance, and who else saw him and in what sequence. To be sure, as Hans Kung says, this is a religious literature. Early Christians were not historians nor scientists, and we cannot expect the kind of precision that would come in a scientific paper. A tolerant viewpoint is required in handling religious sources like these. But sectarians like Walters and the Tanners, who will allow for these tolerances in dealing with their own religious tradition, will not allow it for the Mormons. Walters accepts the gold-digging stories told by Obadiah Dogberry in the Palmyra Reflector, quite uncritically, as he does the testimonies of E.D. Howe. These stories have been examined with care by Hugh Nibley and Richard Anderson, and they have demonstrated that there are major inconsistencies and a very extreme one-sidedness. Why should one give unqualified credence to Dogberry, who so often resorts to hyperbole, and who had a run-in with Joseph Smith regarding the publishing of the Book of Mormon in his newspaper, which he did without permission? Dogberry was obviously contemptuous and biased from this point on, and it reflects in what he wrote. Why accept E.D. Howe when Herbert went to Palmyra deliberately to get something on the Mormons? And this, too, is admitted in the newspapers. Walter's scholarship here, I think, is one of sectarian advantage, not objectivity. The sources Walters and the Tanners employ, the conclusions they reach, the places where they publish, their strong anti-Mormon missionary activities suggest they have other than scholarly concerns. All the sources that I have considered agree that Joseph had an early vision between the ages of 14 and 15. Even Oliver Cowdery said this at first. All agree that Joseph was troubled about religion and that he sought the Lord in prayer. As Jim Allen shows, Joseph never cited his vision with respect to the nature of the Godhead. He did not make that kind of use of the vision. For Joseph, the vision meant something else. It was his way of finding God in his life, gaining forgiveness of sins, wanting to know God's will concerning himself. All accounts agree that the vision started him on the road to becoming a prophet. It seems to me that more can be explained historically by including rather than excluding the first vision. For those who begin with an historical inquiry in mind, what happened, why, what were the consequences, this seems to be the starting place. For sectarians who have other objectives, this may not be sufficient.
My good friend Marvin Hill keeps writing me notes saying your time is up. And so I don't know what the niceties are here, but at least I hope if I'm not praised for my comments, I'm praised for reducing my comments to the least possible denominator, and I'll try my best to cut them down to just a couple of minutes. They paid me such a great salary to be here that I feel I have to at least earn the salary. I couldn't help but reflect that it's been over 15 years now since a lot of us began to talk about and write about and do a little more research on the first vision of Joseph Smith, And as every one of us have written an article here and there, we were absolutely sure that whatever we said at that time was going to solve all the problems for all time, and then somebody else would come along, and he was absolutely sure that he had solved all the problems. And I suppose what I'm saying, that the point about history is that none of us ever really solve all the problems, and Marvin, you haven't done either. So I hope you feel like you're in good company. The topics of these two papers are, of course, quite different in nature, but there's one important theme that both authors touch on that I can't help but begin my commentary with, and they didn't intend to make this their major theme, but it has to do with the historical development of Mormon doctrine, a topic that is receiving growing attention by Mormon scholars. In emphasizing the importance of the 1832 account of the first vision, Marvin also argues that Mormons should accept the idea that Joseph Smith gained the full understanding of the nature of God only after a period of time, not immediately in 1820. And then in discussing the King Follett sermon, Van Hale observed that some ideas presented by Joseph Smith were no longer acceptable to Latter-day Saints some 50 years later, and he raises the question as to how Latter-day Saints respond when they see an early leader teaching one thing that is no longer accepted by the Church. All this, it seems to me, only emphasizes the importance of including at least some historical perspective in our consideration of Mormon teachings. I'm sure that most Latter-day Saints who know much history are fully aware of the tremendous importance of the Nauvoo period to Mormon doctrine. Many of Joseph Smith's most far-reaching and unique revelations came in that period, as did some of his most significant sermons, such as the King Follett sermon. And so, speaking strictly as a church university teacher, and most of you know that I am that, and I am pretty much of a Mormon fundamentalist, I'm greatly concerned with the effect of what we historians do on the lives of our students. This makes it all the more important, it seems to me, that we help our students understand at least some of the historical problems, partly so that we're prepared to wrestle with similar problems when they come along in other forms. And the fact that so many of us face all the time is that historical problems do come along, and our college students, at least, become very much aware of them. Time after time, I have had students express deep concern over the fact that they are not prepared to handle the historical problems, such as the ideas presented in these two papers, when the problems were suddenly thrown at them, either by enemies of the church or by other college students. I believe that some insight into the history of church doctrine can go a long way to helping LDS students maintain their faith in the kind of revelation that I see as a church teacher again, comes line upon line, precept upon precept, as the church and its leaders are prepared to receive it. That is what gives students faith and insight into the need for continuing revelation. Now, all of this, of course, is personal testimony, but I need to get on to my friend Marvin Hill for just a minute. Seems to me that, in a strictly academic and scholarly way, Marvin Hill has done Mormon scholars a service. Hill is a scholar of some national respect and has said, in effect, that those who respect his writings, that Joseph Smith was a man of personal integrity and one who could be trusted. While Hill does not directly approach the question of whether or not one can, quote, prove by empirical evidence that Joseph Smith did or did not have a vision, he nevertheless helps bring to the scholarly world the idea that Joseph was not a charlatan or a deliberate fraud. Hill apparently does not see the necessity to mix his personal faith in his scholarly writings, but his concluding statement nevertheless comes close to making that clear. He says, "All the sources that I have considered agree that Joseph Smith had an early vision between the ages of 14 and 15. But in asking Mormons to accept the primacy of the 1832 account over the official version written in 1838, he may be unrealistic with respect to how far the church can go. But at least he has rationalized for the scholars a way to look at both accounts with respect and without seeing fraud in either one. I do see a couple of problems, however, in Hill's articles, most of which could be easily solved. One has to do with semantics, as reflected in the title, a comment on sectarian versus historical interpretations. That term sectarian, especially if it's published where everybody is going to see it, is a very loaded term, and Hill never defines for us what he really means by it. One assumes that he is defining both the anti-Mormon writers and those whom he calls Mormon apologists as sectarians. But unless Hill defines what he means by the word sectarian, many, if not most, readers will be confused. This is compounded by the fact that neither does he clarify just who he is talking about when he uses another loaded term, apologist. This is usually a very negative term in its connotation, and yet he seems to apply it to certain people such as Hugh Nibley and Richard Anderson, whose work he also praises, at least in the footnote in his article. And when he suggests that somehow Mormon apologist, and does that mean sectarian, is somehow working in opposition to historical interpretation, how does he define which is which? He seems to like some of my work, for example, yet I have publicly classified myself as an apologist, in the positive sense, who tries to come to terms with all the implications of his history. Now, my own stabs at definition may also be problematical, but I make these comments simply to suggest that Hill may be more effective if he could find some way to avoid using such loaded terms as sectarian and apologist that may tend, because they are loaded, to lead some people away from his main points. I also need to give my good friend a gentle chiding on another and relatively minor point. He seems, in one sense, to be almost guilty as I am in setting up a straw man in places. That is, he talks about the scoffers and the naysayers as opposed to the apologists, and then carves out his own position somewhere in between. In doing this, he almost leaves the impression that there has been no middle ground writers. It's true, of course, that on his particular issue, no one has approached it like him, but at least he should observe that there have been all kinds of scholars and writers who have approached Mormonism from a rather neutral point of view. That is, they haven't attempted either to prove or disprove the faith, and we could list a lot of them. With respect to Van Hale, and I just skipped three pages of criticism of Marvin Hill, I'm impressed. And I should say that especially after the section of his that deals with the history of the text, to me the most interesting part of the talk was the question that he raises about the reaction of Mormons when they find that something that was taught in one generation is no longer the doctrine of the church. The evolution of attitudes toward the King Follett discourse is certainly a revelation of the fact that Mormons feel uncomfortable, and rightly so, when they find themselves seeming to disagree either with an early or a contemporary prophet. The only alternatives are either to say that they are wrong now, that the early prophet was wrong then, that the early prophet's words were recorded inaccurately, or that some of the statements made were simply a matter of personal opinion and not a matter of revelation or church doctrine. Hale has handled the various views on the King Follett discourse very well, and made a good observation when he said that any effect or any effort to discuss Joseph Smith's philosophy without considering the King Follett discourse is incomplete or distorted. The main value, then, it seems to me, in this article, and I hope that it sees the light of publication, is the insight it gives us into the workings of the minds of both RLDS and LDS writers who have attempted to confront the issue from time to time. Thank you very much.